Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. Okay, how many of you progressive, activist, radical, lefty, greens, and otherwise concerned citizens share one of my primary guilty pleasures? When you pick up a newspaper, do you reach first for the sports section? When you sit down in front of a television, do you look first for ESPN or today's hottest game? Does your mood revolve not just around whether the world is better off today, but whether the team you root for won or lost? I love sports. I probably had more peak moments in which my ego was dissolved and I was able to merge body, mind, and spirit in the pursuit of a goal in full collaboration with others, playing sports, than doing anything else. And sports have always served as a bridge among strangers as well as friends, whether that's the ability to show up at a basketball court anywhere in the world and join a game within minutes if you can hit your foul shots, or to strike up a conversation with anyone, anywhere, regardless of race, class, faith, nationality. How many fathers and sons have had sports in common when everything else seems strained or broken between them? And all of this has a streak of purity about it. But what about professional sports? This week's guest, Dave Zirin, fills a fairly unique role in our culture. He takes sports seriously enough to be the first sports editor in the 150-year history of The Nation magazine. He has for years, in books, columns, and commentaries, examined both the politics of sports as well as the intersection of the two. Howard Cosell famously said, "Rule number one of the jockocracy was that sports and politics don't mix." In his newest book, Game Over, Zirin asserts that modern professional athletes are breaking that rule like never before. From the NFL lockout and the role of soccer in the Arab Spring, to the Penn State sexual abuse scandals and Tim Tebow's on-field genuflections, Dave reveals how our most important debates about class, race, religion, sex, and political power are being played out both on and off the field. I've left my overzealous interest in sports out of the studio for years. But this week, a couple of weeks after the Super Bowl, not long after Lance Armstrong finally admits to doping, and a few hours before the NBA All-Star Game, I break that barrier. Dave Zirin and I will talk about specific events and athletes, but we'll also examine the role sports play in our individual lives and the larger society. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Dave Zirin, The Nation magazine's first sports writer, is host of Edge of Sports Radio on Sirius XM and a columnist for Slam Magazine and The Progressive. His books include The Giancarlo Story, Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love, A People's History of Sports in the United States, What's My Name, Fool? Sports and Resistance in the U.S., and his latest, Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. Welcome, Dave Zirin, to Pacifica and Free Forum.
Oh, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about, so I'd like you to tell us a bit about your path to the work you do today. You heard my intro, how I've kept sports out of my work for the most part, yet you found a way to bring your two passions together. And basically, your job description didn't exist until you started filling it. So, and feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision.
Sure. I grew up in New York City. I grew up a huge sports fan, played baseball, played basketball, and I didn't really think too much about politics at all. And that changed in 1991. There was a game being played at Madison Square Garden that I went to, and it was during the first Gulf War, and the halftime show involved having one of the mascots beat somebody up in an Arab costume. And my best friend at the time was an Iranian, a young man who was on my high school basketball team with me, and he had actually just been beaten up at an anti-war protest. And it was difficult to think about those things in juxtaposition without actually resenting sports and resenting the role that they were playing in terms of pumping out this information. And it was kind of angering. And I gave up sports then because I thought, wow, sports are part of the problem. It's just some big mechanism to brainwash people. I mean, I was an angry teenager about sports. And then in 1996, there was a basketball player for the Denver Nuggets named Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, who made the decision he wasn't going to come out for the national anthem. And the amount of controversy that sort of focused itself around Rauf and his decision led to some discussions about the history of athlete activists and the history of what people did to use their hyper-exalted moneyed platforms to say something about the world. So I made an effort to try to research and find out what that history was, because I thought I was like Mr. Sports Guy, knew so much about sports and didn't really know anything about the history of people like Jackie Robinson, Billie Jean King, Muhammad Ali, or the great sports writers like Bob Lipsight, and Leonard Schechter, and Shirley Povich, and I didn't know Ralph Wiley. And so it became the sort of thing where I started by looking at the history of it, and then it made me more attuned to seeing moments in contemporary sports that really evoked that history. And it was doing that kind of writing led me to put out my first book and called What's My Name Fool, and that's what got me hired on at The Nation.
Very good. Thanks a lot. That's the voice of Dave Zirin. He is the sports editor for The Nation. He has a radio show, Edge of Sports, on Sirius XM. And his newest book is Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. Now, if you'll indulge me a little, I want to really take a step back and really look at the big picture about the role of sports in society. Have we always played sports?
Well, as a human species, we've certainly always played sports. Anthropologists say as soon as people knew how to clothe themselves or feed themselves and shelter themselves, they played games with one another. I mean, so it's something that's very elementally human. Now, the kinds of sports we play, that's what reflects our bigger world. And that's what makes sense of a given period. Like, the kind of sports we play today really can, in some respects, only be played today the way they're being played today. Because every era really is defined by the sports they play in so many respects, as well as defined by who gets to play. Do women get to play? Do people of color get to play? Do poor people get to play? And as people, are we just people who watch sports while a very small minority of people play? Or are we a society that everybody engages in sports and the line between spectator and participant is very, very fuzzy and people can jump back and forth across those lines? These are questions for particular eras. Do sports reflect war or do they reflect more egalitarian impulses? Are they inclusive or are they exclusive? And so we've always played sports, but the kinds of sports really do very sharply reflect the kinds of societies in which they're played.
Okay, we'll get into that a little more specifically, but when we say we've always played sports, one of the things as I was thinking of this interview was a question of, we know that play is an elemental part of childhood. It's the part, I mean, in any society, even when the adults are busy feeding themselves or hunting or defending themselves, whatever, the children were allowed to play. When I asked that question about have we always played sports, when you answered yes, that's to adults as well. In other words, the fact that not just children get to play, but adults take time out to engage in sports is pretty universal.
Unless it's a situation where adults live in a time of scarcity,
mm-hmm,
and disease, and these questions of food and clothing and shelter aren't answered. But what we know is that as soon as those questions get answered, as soon as a society is at least stable enough to make sure that people aren't being dragged off and killed in the dead of night or dying from plague, that adults as well, absolutely, engage in games, engage in interactions, engage in a kind of structured fun, which is very unique to humans in terms of organizing that structured fun just around themselves.
That's right. In other words, we see other animals doing things that appear to be play, but it's the structure that seems to be the hallmark of humans. I'm going to tell people that I'm Terrence McNally. The other voice is Dave Zirin. He's the Nation Magazine's first sports writer. He's the author of several books. The latest is Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. You can learn more at Edge of Sports, one word, edgeofsports.com. Now, that was playing sports. What about watching sports? In other words, what we're going to talk about, much of what we're going to talk about in the course of this hour, has to do with spectator sports. How universal is that?
Well, that actually goes back as long a ways, too. I mean, there's evidence of structured games that had audiences dating back deep into indigenous tribes, African tribes, Europe as well. So, you know, that spans different societies, different cultures, etc. The thing that marks our society as really different, and by our society I'm really talking from like the 1880s forward, post-Civil War forward, is what we're really talking about here is an actual wall in between who watches and who plays.
Because
there's evidence, when, for example, in when indigenous tribes, when they would play, it was like people would watch and play, and then people who would sit would then run in and play, and the people who were playing would then run back out and watch. And these games could last over the course of 3 or 4 days. They could incorporate like all kinds of food and cookouts. Breaks would be taken, and so everything sort of flowed together with food, ceremony, fellowship, play, and spectatorship. But it's really only when sports get professionalized, and you don't see that until after the Civil War, is when you get like this kind of very sharp division between who gets to watch and who gets to play.
Now, you mentioned after the Civil War, that obviously focuses on the United States. Was this wall and this professionalization first in the United States? I mean, obviously, football and cricket are sports that have long histories in other nations.
Yeah, no, they're predated from the Civil War in other countries. You see, what the Civil War did, of course, was like it united the industrial North with the quasi-feudal slave South, which created a kind of unified space to be able to then have professional leagues that were national in character. In Europe, you do see it date earlier than then, going back, so you could call it the early part of the 19th century. So as soon as like you have a stable kind of urban setting and a stable set of just urban life, is when you then start to see the growth of these kinds of professional sports. But it's worth noting that whether you're talking about Europe at this time or whether you're talking about the United States as well, there's this gap between what are thought of as high sports and low sports. And you see this in the U.S. before the Civil War as well. You see this dating back to, Jesus, like the 18th century, like this idea that there are sports that if you are a gentleman,
mm-hmm.
emphasis on the man part, but if you are upper crust gentleman, there were sports you took part in, and those sports would be like horseback riding, for example. Whether you're talking about like a horseback, like whether racing or tricks or whatever it might be. But then there's the low sports, and the low sports would involve like working class pastimes where people would crowd into basements and bet on everything from bare knuckle boxing to sports that were called like bear baiting, where they would starve a dog. And a dog would like fight a bear, like in the middle of a basement, in a squalid slum, or sometimes it would be called like rat fighting, where you would have just like this disgusting pit filled with rats, and you would throw in a couple of dogs, once again starved and beaten, and you would see who could eat the most rats. So you had this very, very serious divide between high sports and low sports, between conceptions of high culture and low culture. And part of the professionalization of sports in the late 19th century was really also about social reformers in both European and U.S. society trying to figure out a way to really bring millions of immigrant youth into the culture while not having them exposed at the same time to sports that were uniquely violent or brutal or would not prepare them for the greatness that people foresaw that America would take on in the 20th century.
This is interesting stuff. I really appreciate you for going back this far with me. We'll get to the present day before the hour's over, but I really appreciate this. Now let me talk just about the my own experience playing and watching, and sort of what the students of this, shall we say, think about this. Now I find playing sports, as I mentioned a bit in the intro, nearly unrivaled in terms of mind, body, spirit, in a communal enterprise with teammates and cooperation. Now, dancing, theater, certain moments of work do it, but in my life, nothing has as consistently, basically as soon as the ball is in play, if you will, you know, all that other stuff disappears and this stuff takes hold. Do the experts, if you will, do they basically see a lot of value in the playing of sports?
Well, I think most people would agree who do this for a living, who observe it, certainly people who have kids who play sports. So whether you're talking about at the professional level or at the youngest amateur levels, I got to say that there's uniform agreement that sports is kind of like a fire, and you could use a fire to cook your food or you can use fire to burn down your house, that it can be a very powerful tool. It's a powerful tool regardless of what you do with it. But whether or not it does something positive or does something negative is really about the people who wield it, whether it's how a coach chooses to teach, whether it's the parents on the sideline and how they interact with their kids, whether it's a spirit of community like you described and certainly like I experienced growing up, or whether it's a community based on fear
and bullying and that sort of thing.
Or homophobia or what have you, that far too many locker rooms look like as well. So, I mean, I think that without question, sports is a powerful force, and without question, it can have an incredibly positive role on people's lives. But we'd be remiss not to mention that there are a lot of people who have very different experiences.
Yes, right. In other words, the bullying, you talked about the wall between professional athletes and spectators. In so many cultures, I'm talking about like high school and junior high school cultures, there's a wall between those who excel and those who don't.
And we can't say that sports are universally positive, even if it was positive for me, and even though people will testify to it, you know, up and down the line. If 70% of 13-year-olds who played youth sports quit, they quit when they're 13 years old.
Wow.
Oftentimes over the objection of their parents. That's 70%. And when people have actually done the research to say, well, why is it? One of the main reasons is that by the time they're 13, they're old enough to say, I'm sick of this BS. I'm sick of the pressure. I'm sick of the extra hours it takes. I'm sick of all of it. And sometimes that's also accompanied by the fact that the teams get more competitive when you hit your 12, 13 years old. That's the junior high years. And all of a sudden, you know, the game that was like, hey, everybody who signs up can play, all of a sudden it becomes, no, you're not good enough, go away. And oftentimes that's also accompanied by greater financial demands among the families, you know, about like, well, this is a traveling team, so you have to pay more money. Oh, your kid needs the right sneakers now.
Yeah.
That costs more money. So there's a way in which, you know, sports, which is supposed to be this all-inclusive place for kids, actually alienates the majority of kids who get involved in it. And then we wonder why we have issues like childhood diabetes problems or youth obesity problems. And that's, to me, the worst part about sports, to me, because I love sports and I've seen how positive it can be. And there's no reason why it shouldn't be something where, as long as you like it, you can play.
Yeah.
It's healthy for you, it's healthy for the community, it's healthy for everybody. That doesn't mean you don't have to also have these hyper-competitive leagues, but there should be room in the world of sports for everybody, even if you're so-called too fat, too short, too slow, and all the different ways you sort of get otherized if you don't look like, you know, young Michael Jordan or something.
Yeah, you know, I'm just going to share, I'm older than you, Dave, graduated high school in 65, and I think this super organization and almost the professionalization of youth sports had not really occurred yet. Do you know what I mean?
Definitely not.
And I skipped a grade and was very small, you know, always a bit small. And so I was not good enough to get into the hyper-competitive thing. I just played in the driveway or played in the schoolyard, and so I never experienced that stuff. Let me tell people again, I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Dave Zirin. He's the Nation magazine's first sports writer. He's the author of several books. The latest is Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down, and has a radio show on Sirius FM. And you can learn more at edgeofsports.com, edgeofsports, one word, .com. So now let's talk about the watching of sports. Now, I find some things. I've asked myself, why am I attracted to watching sports, which in some ways is not that like playing them. And I think, and again, I'm asking for, you know, you've done a lot of watching sports, obviously, and a lot of thinking about this. I think one is the fact that they take place in real time. And even if I'm watching something I've recorded, and even sometimes if I know the score, the action still unfolds in real time, and I think that gives it a certain quality. And second is, I'll talk about a little bit more in a moment, is the element of story, conflict, drama, you know, that sort of thing. Your thoughts?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the reason why the NBA avoids Las Vegas like the plague and won't even consider an expansion team in Las Vegas, the reason why even the whiff of a betting scandal in any of the major sports usually is precipitated by followed up by some massive crisis and a lot of investigations and a lot of concern and a lot of op-eds, is because this question of not knowing what the final score is going to be, that's really the only thing that separates sports from the unscripted element of it. It makes it very unique on the cultural landscape. I mean, there's so many people fighting for your attention, for your eyeballs, whether it's, you know, going online now or whether it's with a whole host of reality shows, regular shows, movies, what have you, or heaven forbid, you know, not looking at a screen for a while and just getting out of the house. But when it comes to sports, the one thing it has over all these other elements is at least selling the idea that there's no BS here.
Yeah.
That this is happening as it happens. There's no screenwriter. There's no person behind the scenes. There's no nothing. And that's why even though anybody can bet online now on any of these games, the sports leagues take such issue when, for example, say a state governor tries to legalize gambling in a given state, whether it's New Jersey or right here in Maryland, it's always the sports leagues who step up and say, no, it's a slippery slope towards betting on sports, and we don't want even the slightest appearance that betting lines have anything to do with our game. And that comes from this kind of like manic phobia about anybody seeing the games as fixed.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, that's also why it's such a big deal when people make accusations about certain players being favored, certain calls only going against certain players. I mean, the league, always, as self-evident as that is,
yeah,
that
exactly.
Referees are human and it affects their minds when they're out there on the court, as self-evident as that is, it's something that the league, so they always bristle against so much because they know that's their little diamond at the center of this. That's their one little edge that they have over everybody else, that theirs is the unscripted entertainment.
That's right. No matter how many billions are involved and no matter, as we say, how professionalized it becomes, it still really all rests on that, on that element. I'm sure you're aware of the study of why there is a home field advantage in sports. And
sure.
As much as they could isolate out variables, what they found was that the home crowd, it isn't so much that it influences the team to play better. There's some of that, I think, in terms of momentum and that sort of thing. But it's that the referees in soccer, in basketball, in all sports, end up leaning toward the home crowd, and they just can't help it.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. They're human beings. It's a human element. I think a lot of the referees, they do a thankless job. They get terribly underpaid relative to the job they're asked to do. But there is psychology in sports. I mean, and I think particularly in sports where it's not just bam, bam, reflex response, whether you're talking about umpires or talking about players. But sports where you actually have to sit there and think and you get to look at something and then determine it, I mean, that's to me when those voices start whispering in your ears and you start feeling the 50,000 people sort of peering over, waiting for what you're about to say.
That's the pass interference call in professional football, or the a charge or block call in professional basketball.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that other thing I was saying, and the second half we'll get into more of the elements in the book, but the other one is the element of story. I teach the power of storytelling, and one thing I often say is I use the example of sports writing. In a baseball season, professional baseball season, there are at least 162 games, which in essential ways are very similar, and the only truly consequential information is the final score, right? And the job of the sports writer is to find the story and the character elements that bring that particular game to life differently than the one yesterday and the one tomorrow. The fact that the star is in a slump, that the pitcher has lost to this opposing team three times in a row, that someone has been traded and this is the first time they're playing against their former team. They go into the locker room, come up with a story, and take those essentially similar elements and paint them into these stories. Your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, what they're also trying to do is also train the viewer to not see this as a completely random enterprise, which is like if you go into it just thinking, well, there's a 7 out of 10 chance this batter is about to be out, and you just watch it on that basis, then it becomes a kind of statistical enterprise. And there are people these days who feel like you can understand more about the game by just looking at the numbers afterwards and not actually judging what happens on the field. And they actually have a lot of validity
right
to back them up on this.
Yeah,
that you can probably be a top-notch general manager by just looking at certain statistical numbers and by privileging some statistics over others rather than actually getting a feel for the game. Now, what the announcer and the sports writer's job is to do is to get people to say, well, wait a minute, there are certain variables at play, which remove this from being a statistician's exercise or even remove it from being prose, and we're going to turn this into poetry. Like, yeah, this particular hitter, maybe he bats 220, but he has a 300 average against this particular pitcher, and he's particularly good at hitting curveballs. So this just might be his lucky day.
Yep.
You see, then that creates up a very different narrative, because then if he does get a hit, then the sports writer gets to say, oh, true to form, true to patterns. That's why scouting is so important. They should have taken that pitcher out. But then if the batter strikes out, then the narrative gets to be like, wow, that's a particularly impressive strikeout, given that he's going against a hitter who hits 300 against him and is great at hitting that curveball. So you get to create these mini narratives that are based on a very human element instead of just saying, you know, like, what are you going to do? It's a random exercise.
Yeah.
By numbers.
Right.
And I could probably tell you within 5 games right now who's going to win the World Series in October.
Yeah. Very good. That's the voice of Dave Zirin. He's the Nation Magazine's sports editor. His latest book is Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. And you can learn more about all of his work at edgeofsports.com. Let's move to current society. I'm sure you get asked this a lot. Is sports serving the larger society? Well, let's restrict ourselves to the U.S. for this question. Or are they an opiate of the people, a distraction?
Well, I mean, in some respect, I would go for neither of the above on that one. Because, I mean, first on the question of it being an opiate for people, obviously, you know, the reason why I wrote the book is because I think sports actually tells much richer, deeper, and more political stories than it just being a distraction. I mean, a distraction is when you turn on your TV and you turn to a channel that just shows bright colors for 8 hours and you just stare at that. I mean, sports actually has some content to it, and it talks about human interaction. It talks about political issues, sometimes not explicitly, but there's an undercurrent of it. I mean, just watching in the gear up for the last Super Bowl, I mean, you had everything from a player on the Ravens who was talking about LGBT rights to players on the 49ers who were saying all this homophobic stuff to the fact that you had the Newtown choir singing God Bless America before the start of the game, not to mention just the corporate bombardment during the game, not to mention the live shots of Camp Courage in Afghanistan. So, I mean, so it this is obviously more than just an opiate, because you got all kinds of things at play here, and we didn't even get to Beyonce, and yet it's all this stuff is juggling around your eyes. But then it's like the sports serve society. I mean, I think sports in its 21st century form as a business is doing society a grave disservice. And that's not just for the United States, but it's nationally. I mean, I think this thing where we build stadiums with public money has become the closest thing to a substitute for any like real urban policy that we have anymore. And what it does is it rings up huge debts. The cities don't get paid back for the money they put in. It takes public wealth and turns it in magically into private profit. And it creates thousands of low-paying, non-union jobs. I mean, so it becomes like this neoliberal Trojan horse, where wrapped in the trappings of sports, wrapped in the fun of sports, wrapped in what people love about sports, becomes an economic poison pill that really, I think, the 99% of us have no real interest in. So, and that to me is just very tragic, because it's about taking something people love and using it against them. So I take great exception to that. But I mean, in terms of like other issues with regards to sports, then they do serve a greater good. So some of the issues you were talking about at the start, it's like community, cohesiveness, a sense of being able to talk to people over lines of division that usually separate us. I mean, these are beautiful things. It's just tragic that so much of the time sports is, because it speaks to the best angels of our nature, is used for very destructive ends.
Yeah, in other words, the very fact that it has this role in so many people's lives makes it a wonderful tool if you can manipulate those people, because it has that impact on their lives and runs
exactly
in their blood. Let me ask you, you've written a number of books. This one feels a little different in that this one feels like a bit more optimistic in some ways. What led to this book, Game Over?
Well, it started really because I felt like there had been this massive sea change in sports since roughly 2008, and it just wasn't being talked about. So it's kind of like me trying to shake some of these sports writers and also talk to fans about the fact that you're watching something very different than you were watching 5 years ago. And there have been all these low-frequency to high-frequency political changes over the last 5 years. And I talk about them in the book, but, I mean, everything from the economic crisis in 2008, which triggered four different lockouts in sports because owners were getting less public subsidies for a short period of time anyway, to the growth of people talking about gay rights in sports, I think has really confronted the way sports is often used to construct this kind of toxic masculinity and toxic femininity as a way to, you know, really, really typecast gender roles in society. I think people fighting for LGBT rights in sports has changed that. And then also the issue with everything we know now about the NFL and head injuries and concussions has taken the most popular sport in the land and put it under the microscope. And so these are huge changes in sports, and they really changed the way we watch or the way we don't watch the games. And it was pretty striking to me that no one was really taking a step back and looking at this. So that's why I wrote the book.
Okay, let's go to some of those in particular. The first one is the public subsidies. Los Angeles has been without the NFL for a couple of decades now because they said no. They said, we will not put public funds into a sports stadium. And I think the reason being, we're L.A., we've got enough going on without it. What is kind of the general course of events in terms of payback or economic value of these subsidies?
Well, now, of course, and also we know that in L.A., it's like as soon as the whistle goes and you guys get a team like the San Diego Chargers, public funding construction is going to begin and build a stadium. So, I mean, the city council has pledged public funds. It's just all done, and you have some real estate baron who's pledged to put up something like $800 million of his own money too into this. But the trigger for all of it is having a team say, okay, we'll go there. And I mean, I feel, just to talk about LA, that LA has much more value to the NFL as a kind of stalking horse.
Oh, exactly. Explain that to people, because that's clearly been, yes, LA has been enormously useful to the NFL and its owners because the threat is always there. You'll lose your team to LA. There's this big city, this big pool of money waiting out there for your team.
And it's more useful to the NFL, is that, because remember, the NFL doesn't need LA the way other sports leagues do, because even though LA is the second biggest media market in the country, you also have this issue where the NFL pools its money and divides it and has a massive television contract. So its need for L.A. is secondary, I think, to its need to have L.A. without a team. So it can be the one place that that they can say viably, well, we'll go there if you don't give this money. You've seen Ziggy Wolf, the owner of the Minnesota Vikings, say this for the state of Minnesota: build me a new stadium or I'm moving to L.A. You hear similar rumblings out of San Diego, the San Diego Chargers, and it's the sort of thing where I think a city would have to be on the brink of economic collapse and just say, if you want another stadium, you're really going to have to go to L.A. because we really have nothing, and which I think could very well happen in the next few years somewhere
right
in this country. But short of that, L.A. is not getting a team.
That's astute analysis. I see that. And the distinction there that you made is that the NFL pools its TV money and the other leagues do not, or less so?
That the other leagues are horrible at revenue sharing. And it's all to a greater or lesser degree that they do it, but only the NFL does real and full revenue sharing.
I got it.
Because we put all the revenue in a pot, and then we divide it up. Everybody, everywhere else, shifts it and shakes it around. So you get a situation where it takes a team like the Portland Trailblazers 11 years to make what the Lakers make in 1 year in television money.
Oh, my God. Yeah, the television money, obviously, for people who've been following this sort of thing, the small market, large market discrepancy has been greatly exaggerated by, I think, New York was the first one with its Madison Square Garden network, mm-hmm. but now L.A., the TV contracts that both the Angels and the Dodgers have signed have put them in this elite class with New York. And I guess the Texas Rangers have a similarly, are not quite as much, but a very rich TV contract too. And it's these local cable deals that really change the haves and the have-nots.
Yeah, and two things about that. First of all, those cable costs also get passed down to every consumer on their
cable bill. Who doesn't even care about sports, they're paying for...
They care less about sports, and they're paying to subsidize Magic Johnson and the Guggenheim Corporation's buy of the L.A. Dodgers.
Yep.
And the L.A. Times wrote about this. I mean, I wish it had gotten more play, but they wrote about the fact that everybody celebrating the Guggenheim-Magic Johnson deal should also realize that their cable bill is going to go up because of this deal.
Yeah.
The two are actually directly linked. And that's very problematic, to put it mildly. I mean, that's organized theft more than it's anything else. But one of the things that the cable issue shows, and the subsidy issue shows, is that the economics of sports over the last 30 years have changed dramatically. Like 30 years ago, even 25 years ago, you would judge a team financially, not on the basis of a cable deal or anything like that, but on the basis of how many butts did they put in the seat.
Attendance actually mattered.
Mattered a big time. So whether you're a successful team or not, and I remember growing up, like in the 80s in New York, and they would list the attendance figures next to the box scores, because it was a way that you judge the health of a team. Like, what teams are getting the most butts in the seats?
Wow, yeah.
Nobody cares about that anymore. nobody cares about it. And they don't care about it for the very basic reason that it doesn't really mean anything in terms of what a team is to be able to have or be able to spend. But I'll tell you where it does mean something. It means something because you're really missing out on that old working class to middle class passion for a team. I mean, too many people are priced out of going to the park. Too many families can't go. I was in your neck of the woods speaking at Fremont High School in South Central L.A., and I asked a room of 50 kids, how many of you have ever been to Dodger Stadium? And only one kid raised his hand.
Wow.
That would have been, sociologically speaking, I'll just say my dad grew up a working-class kid in Brooklyn, New York. They used to trade in a couple of milk bottles and go see Brooklyn Dodgers games.
That's right.
So the idea of one kid in my dad's class to say, one out of 50, to say, oh, have you ever seen the Brooklyn Dodgers? It probably would have been more like 40 out of 50.
Right. Well, I remember when I was in grade school, we were allowed to bring little black and white portable TVs into the classroom when the World Series was on. So that because it was that important
during the day,
it was that important,
well.
And the games are held during the day. And I was in Florida, where there wasn't a team closer than I think at that point the Washington Senators.
Yeah, that's right. They
and yet it had that cultural importance among all classes. Now folks get to watch it on TV, and as we see in city after city, but we saw here at the start of the NBA season. That's only if the cable folks are willing to pay the price, and only if you have cable in many cases.
And this is where you see sports really as a big, I want to say reflection of the financial industry in this country, but instead it's probably more accurate to call it an extension of the financial industry in this country, partly because a lot of the owners of sports teams also have a foot in the financial industry. So they're not just reflecting the business practices of high finance, but they're actually an extension of them in that the short-sightedness, like not looking long-term, counting on government bailouts, not thinking about how to create a sustainable product or a sustainable line or a sustainable business structure. And it's all, what will the next profit look like and how will I get it? And if you can't get it, then you see yourself as behind, even if you're still making money hand over fist.
Right. Well, one thing I hear you saying is, and I'm just adding to your own point, but that just as business in America so often looks only at the next quarter, and so the middle class is disappearing, the middle class doesn't have enough money to buy the products, they're violating Henry Ford's wisdom that you need to pay people enough to buy your products. Likewise, that's exactly what we're saying about sports, that the large middle class of people have been priced out of really playing in your game.
And so other than the NFL, I think you can describe the sports world today as there has never been more money, and yet the interest is not correlating with that money. And that's a very, very dangerous formula.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the LGBT piece here. We saw, and I'm going to introduce it for, let me talk race and then go to LGBT because I see sort of LGBT as the next horizon. In race, I suppose people are aware of this, but the numbers are amazing in terms of players and then much less so in terms of management. In the NBA, 83% non-white. 78% black, 4% Latino, 1% Asian, only 17% white. And as we know, a number of those are the European and Eastern European imports. Major League Baseball, 61.5% white, only 8% black, and 11% foreign black, which is basically Latino black, and then Hispanic 17%. So if you add those two data, you got 28% Hispanic, 61.5% white. The NFL, I didn't realize this, black 67%, Hispanic 1%, Asian Pacific 2%, and white 30%. Any reflections from you on some of those numbers?
Well, I mean, one of the things I say right away is that it's also a lot of those numbers come very disproportionately from the South and Southeast of the United States as well. And I remember I asked a coach from Mississippi about that, and he said, well, when you have economic problems, when you have poverty, when you have racism, and when you have year-round sunshine, you have the perfect soil to make pro athletes. And so that's a lot of the numbers really are governed by that. I mean, some of the things that are probably the most striking, first of all, is they're actually the number of African-American players in the NBA has gone down, actually. And the number of African-American players in Major League Baseball has gone down dramatically. And that is because Major League Baseball has made a massive investment, particularly in the Dominican Republic, but in Latin America, where they can sign players for as little as $1,000 when they're 15 years old, and can even start scouting players when they're 8 or 9 years old through these intermediary scouts. And, of course, for those players who then sign up and get to go to these baseball factories when they're 15, if by the time they're 18 years old, if they're not good enough for a contract, they just get discarded. So you got in thousands and 99% don't make it. I mean, some clubs it's a little better, but like the best I ever saw was 93% don't make it. So you're not talking about something that's very viable, but it's also one of the only ways to get out of poverty in the Dominican Republic.
Right.
I believe it's almost 70% of the country lives below the poverty line. So that's the thing that's most striking when I think about demographics and sports. The other thing that's very striking to me also is like that number. I mean, it's more a class question than a race question with the NFL, but it's like I really do wonder if in a generation it's only going to be poor kids playing in the National Football League, because middle class parents aren't going to want to subject their kids to the kind of head injuries that we now know can take effect as young as when they're 8 or 9 years old.
Now,
Let me jump in for one second on this one.
It seems to me this is something which has this head injury fear or attention to head injury with football seems to – we all kind of have known it, but really in the last 2, 3, 4 years has accelerated to where now people question whether what is at the moment the most powerful sports entity – maybe ever, the NFL, and how its years may be numbered. What do you imagine? What's your guess as to how different it will be? How soon?
I don't think it's going to be that different. I just think that the pool of young people who play it is going to change. It's already obviously a lot of poor kids who become NFL players. I think that's going to change, though, to make it even more pronounced. Like, for example, the 3 amazing rookies from this year's NFL season were Robert Griffin III, Andrew Luck, and Russell Wilson.
Yep.
3 quarterbacks, 2 of them African-American. What all 3 of them have in common, though, is that they all grew up in very, very stable middle to upper middle class homes. And they all had skills in multiple sports. And I just think in the future, that's exactly the kind of kid whose parents are going to steer them away from playing. Because of studies that show that when you play Pop Warner football, you're susceptible to the same injuries that people in the NFL get. And so there's a lot of parents who are going to keep their kids away from this. So that's one thing that's going to change. I also think it's going to eventually be illegal for kids under 14 to play.
That these peewee leagues won't start as early.
Yeah, that'll start at 14 because you're going to get into some serious litigious issues.
Right, as the research improves, right.
Yep, and the 2 words that every sports fan is going to have to know, even though they're not going to like knowing them, are informed consent. And if you are putting 8 or 9-year-olds in harm's way and they're too young to have what the courts call informed consent, then maybe it'll be the leagues. Hell, maybe it'll even be the parents are going to get sued. And it's going to become too expensive to actually insure these kids. Now, will this lead to prohibition-style smoker games where people are playing youth football in dark and dank basements in South Texas and you have to know a password to get in? That's possible. That could definitely happen. Prohibition certainly tends not to end things in this country, as we well know, on a host of issues.
Well, it's interesting, by the way, Texas already leads us in those 7-on-7 passing leagues, which is developing all the best quarterbacks, and those are not tackle, correct?
Right, that's exactly right.
So there,
exactly
that, right. that may be one of the futures, that it already works to feed the best. I mean, if you look at the best quarterbacks that are coming out of the colleges, the huge percentage of them come out of those 7-on-7 no-tackle leagues in Texas. We've only got this has been so fascinating. We've only got 3 minutes left. What I want to give you a chance to do, rather than some of the things I said before, is briefly highlight some of the positives, some of the heroes, if you will, whether it's Steve Nash, LeBron James, et cetera, Scott Fujita, folks who you think are changing the way athletes think of themselves and take their place in society.
Absolutely, and these are stories I highlight in the book. But first of all, the soccer fan clubs in Egypt,
yes,
are organizing to lead revolution against autocracy in Egypt, and that's an incredible thing that's happening, and it's changing the way people look at sports and sports fans. The second thing that I think is incredibly positive is the way LeBron James has morphed from being yet another selfish athlete to being the kind of person who organizes his teammates to take a stand for Trayvon Martin, and that I lead the book off with that story because it's such a great sign of what's happening these days. And also look at a young man named Royce White,
mm-hmm,
right now. Royce White, who played rookie with the Houston Rockets, who's got an anxiety disorder, and he's trying to bring the issue of mental illness out of the closet, so to speak, and really talk about this. And then there are organizations like You Can Play, which is organizing to make sports more open and accessible to LGBT youth. I mean, these are the things that inspire me because I understand the cultural platform that sports has. And like I said at the beginning, sports is like a fire, and you could use a fire to cook a meal or burn down your house. And I feel very, very confident in the quality of chefs we have who are coming into the game these days.
And a brief thought on why you think we're seeing more of that. Obviously, each case is individual,
yeah,
but is it the internet?
No, there's some big trends. I think the internet plays a huge part in it. The existence of social media, the ability of players to actually speak their own mind and control their own image, I think is a huge part of it. But I also think it's more a question that we've had major crisis in this country and in this world over the last 5 years. And like one of the athletes says to me in the book, he says, look, it's not like we have our own CNN. It's like we're part of this world too. And I just think that's what we're really seeing, is that even in that hermetically sealed environment that is the 21st century athlete, you're seeing real change.
Okay. Again, the book is Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. You've got a taste of what this book talks about, is how these shifts are happening right now in the way politics and sports overlap and in the way athletes, professional athletes, are seeing themselves. To learn more about Dave Zirin's work, go to Edge of Sports, one word, edgeofsports.com. He hosts Edge of Sports on the Sirius XFM satellite radio. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. You can do both of those things at iTunes and at my site. For podcasts, articles, and transcripts of interviews, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. That's all one word. They're the same website. And if you want to receive my weekly email announcement of upcoming guests and issues with two or three articles of background, you can sign up at the site or by emailing me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com. And finally, thank you again to Dave Zirin. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.